Normally, being a little extra might be a bit much, but not when it comes to healthcare. That's why UnitedHealthcare's Health Protector Guard fixed indemnity insurance plans, underwritten by Golden Rule Insurance Company, supplement your primary plan so you manage out-of-pocket costs. Learn more at uh1.com.
I'm Sandra, and I'm just the professional your small business was looking for. But you didn't hire me because you didn't use LinkedIn Jobs. LinkedIn has professionals you can't find anywhere else, including those who aren't actively looking for a new job, but might be open to the perfect role. Like me.
In a given month, over 70% of LinkedIn users don't visit other leading job sites. So if you're not looking on LinkedIn, you'll miss out on great candidates like Sandra. Start hiring professionals like a professional. Post your free job on linkedin.com/people today.
Welcome to the Lords Podcast with Will Rowe.
Well, welcome along to the latest edition of the Lords Podcast. As winter creeps in here at St. John's Wood, we look forward to the Ashes as the return series begins down under, discuss sport and cricket psychology following the first London Sports Writing Festival, and reflect on MCC's most recent cricket tour to Uganda. In the history section of the podcast, we catch up with former England spin bowler Deadly Derek Underwood, as he remembers taking wickets galore at the home of cricket and going on tour to Australia. Well, we're up here in the JP Morgan Media Centre looking out at the ground today, and it's my great pleasure to welcome my co-host this month, a former Ashes-winning captain, Middlesex captain. He currently works for the England and Wales Cricket Board as the Managing Director of Cricket Partnerships. And last but by no means least, he's the new MCC President, Mr. Mike Gatting. Welcome.
Good morning.
How are you doing?
Very good, thank you, mate.
What's it like being at Lords on a winter's morning?
Well, it doesn't look too wintry. I mean, there's another cloud in the sky. You could almost play cricket, probably, and the ground's looking in great nick because I think we've had some great ground weather for the season. It just looks like it's almost ready to start again, but I'm sure Mick will be looking forward to just giving it a bit of a rest. But no, it's always lovely to be here. The flag's flying up there very proudly, and yeah, it's sunny.
Your first month, and how's it been as president?
I've probably done more revision this first month than I ever did at school for any exams when it came down to my first meeting, the SGM. I've been to, obviously, one or two very, very nice dinners. We had the World Championship of Real Tennis, and that was really quite special, that. The two guys really played extremely well and kept us entertained for about 3.5 hours. And then we had a wonderfully colourful Armed Forces dinner as well, Cricket Society, one or two others. But it's really been quite special. I think the Wisden Cricketer dinner was quite good too. So it's been busy. We just got through the first month, and we've probably got the busiest coming up, obviously, with a tour to Australia, and we'll be out there, obviously, with a few members too, just seeing how they tour.
What's it like going to Australia as a tourist?
It is quite special. You know it's quite special. When you get out there, they make sure you know you're in Australia, and they make sure they know that you're going to get beaten by the Aussies because you're Poms. And it's very, very competitive, almost bordering aggressive at times. But they do like... If they do like you, they like you, and they tell you so, and they respect you for what you've done. And I think that's really the thing you try and do when you leave Australia, is to earn their respect, and hopefully you might have won doing it. If you haven't won, but I still think they respect people who do have the attributes that they think are the right attributes for being an international cricketer.
And Andrew Strauss, of course, won down there recently. But before that, you were the last captain to lead an England side to victory. I mean, that must be something you're very proud of.
Yeah, very proud. You know, you don't have to go down there, especially when you were told there's only three things you couldn't do. That's bat, bowl and field, which was quite quite extraordinary just before you'd even started the tour. I mean, it was quite special. And you don't quite realise how special it is till you get at home, actually. You can see when you're out there the crowds sort of growing. I mean, the expat crowds, not the Aussie crowds. And when they start showing tennis on the big screens because they're not doing so well in the cricket, you know you've actually done a good job. And it was not just the Test Series we won, but we did manage to win the other two one-day competitions. I don't think it'll ever happen again because there were three competitions, which was a Perth Challenge and obviously the World Series. But Playing against the sides we had to, which is, you know, Pakistan, Australia, West Indies, and India, probably the only side there that you know, could have been, if you like, probably in the top four or five at the time. So it was a very, 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 very special trip. Yeah, very special trip, and a lot of people played awfully well. And the nice thing was, because you only had sort of 16 players, you had to get through. You didn't have one-day players coming in, or T20 players coming in, or whatever. So there were 16 of us, and we managed to get through four and a half months and win everything. So it was a huge effort by everybody concerned on that trip, and it was tremendous.
Long old tour. And your current work at the ECB, I've got here, Managing Director of Cricket Partnerships.
It's been quite interesting, because now I'm more involved in the recreational game, trying to change a few things there, trying to help the cricket boards become high-performing cricket boards, and trying to sort of get people to understand that insight is an important thing, and how we use insight to find out what our customers want. And also media. I mean, the social media is just huge, and people don't do things even on emails these days. It's all Facebook and Twitter. So, you know, getting people to understand that that's absolutely, you know, enormously important. So you need people within your organisations who are comfortable doing that. So there's a huge thing. So, yeah, apart from all the sort of schools and the clubs and finding facilities, women's and girls' disabilities, it covers a whole lot. And I've got a great group of people called our partnership management team, and they look after the coaching, and they look after the umpiring and the funding facilities, etc. So it's a really good group, very talented people in there, and very passionate people.
It's great that you just mentioned Twitter, because it flows quite nicely into what we're about to do now. When we found out that you were happy to come on the podcast, we went on Twitter, on the Home of Cricket account, and we got a few questions for you. So we're just going to fire through them, if that's okay. So this one's from John Peachy. He says, ask Mr. Gatting, does he remember June pouring tea over him at Kent? I was the chef.
I do indeed. It was quite a painful affair. Sadly, I mean, June was a lovely lady, and she'd been down at Kent and been, if you like, the tea lady. And we all got a great respect for tea ladies and dinner ladies. And, you know, it was just one of those very sad things. She had just got out a nice fresh pot of tea for us, and she was proudly coming along to pour it over into my cup. And I think one of her heels got stuck in the floorboards, or something happened. She just got it in a mat or something, and she just sort of tripped up, and it was the old comedy sketch of it just being thrown all over my chest. Now, fortunately, I just had a T-shirt on, but it was so hot, it really was quite amazing. And I think for the rest of the afternoon, I sort of sat down with sort of ice packs intermittently on and off my chest to stop the sort of blistering and stuff. So it was a bit of a premature end to that game of cricket for me, but I do remember it very well, and I know June's a lovely lady, and she was so upset, and she was beside herself, but you know, accidents happen, but it was rather painful.
Our next question is, how many MCC out matches will you be playing in 2014?
Do you know what? I haven't even thought about it, to be perfectly honest with you. I mean, there's so much going on at the moment. I think when I took over, you know, there was obviously the SGM, and then there was Australia going to be looming quickly, and you got our club dinners and the meetings, and then all the sort of functions you have to go to. So I hadn't really thought about that. I suppose perhaps once I'm watching cricket over in Australia, I'll see how fit I can get myself on my month's trip, and see where we get to. But I'll try and play one or two, I'm sure.
Fantastic. I'm sure you've been asked this one before, but it's from Paul Garwood. Fastest bowler you've ever faced?
Well, I think there were probably three spells by different bowlers, which I suppose, depending on what period of time of your cricketing career you face them, they do tend to sort of have a resonance about them. But certainly the first one was in my young days, when Michael Holden was bowling in one of my first test matches, and that was at Old Trafford, and I thought he bowled very, very quick there. Although having bowled very quick 4 years earlier at the Oval, I know he bowled mightily quick, and that was one where, you know, it was quick. the other one was Sylvester Clarke at the Oval, and Silvers could bowl quick at many times, but this one was probably the only time I hadn't seen a cricket ball, and I sort of just almost stuck my head, and it just flicked the helmet and went for sort of one bounce four to the pavilion, and that's quite a long way back, and it nearly was six, actually, leg-wise. That's how it was. And the next ball was very similar. Fortunately, I saw that one And it's amazing how the senses and the brain sort of, you know, acclimatises so quickly. And this one just brushed the side piece. I was getting out of the way of it. And that too sort of went for four leg by. So that was quite a quick spell for about five or six overs. And then Alan Donald, a lot of members probably will remember when Curtly Ambrose ran in and bowled that first ball that bounced off a length and went straight over Michael Atherton's head at Edgbaston. We had to play on that wicket about after they'd finished. It finished in 3 days, so it didn't get much use, so they used it in a one-day match. And Alan Donald was bowling, and it is quite a short boundary at Edgbaston if you're backing onto the pavilion there, or the old pavilion, that is. And he was only about 10 yards shy of the boundary. That was how quick it was, and that was only in a one-day match. So they were three of the spells that I can remember being very, very quick.
So Holding, Clark and Donald, those three. Amazing. Do you think media hype is getting in the way of the game? That's from Kim Parker.
I'm Sandra, and I'm just the professional your small business was looking for. But you didn't hire me, because you didn't use LinkedIn Jobs. LinkedIn has professionals you can't find anywhere else, including those who aren't actively looking for a new job, but might be open to the perfect role, like me.
In a given month, over 70% of LinkedIn users don't visit other leading job sites. So if you're not looking on LinkedIn, you'll miss out on great candidates, like Sandra. Start hiring professionals like a professional. Post your free job on linkedin.com/people today.
Tired of ads interfering with your favorite sports podcasts? Good news. Ad-free listening is available on Amazon Music for all the music plus top podcasts included with your Prime membership. Stay ahead of the game by downloading the Amazon Music app for free or go to amazon.com/sports ad free. That's amazon.com/sports ad free to catch up on the latest episodes without the ads.
Hey there, it's Michelle Norris. I'm host of a podcast called Your Mama's Kitchen. When I travel, I'm usually looking for a way to find a taste of home when I'm not at home. And one of the things I love to do when I am at home is entertain. And Airbnb allows me to do that. When I was in California recently, I rented a house that had a great kitchen. And when we were sitting around the table, we're all thinking, we're in someone else's house. Someone could be in all of our homes as well. If you have a home, but you're not always at home, you have an Airbnb. Your home might be worth more than you think. Find out how much at airbnb.com/host.
Media hype is always there. You know, we, I think, possibly went through probably one of the worst periods of media in the 80s. It really got quite horrible, really. Sort of went up the ladder from sort of common or garden cricketers like ourselves up to sort of captains and then managers and then sort of politicians and sadly got up to the royal family. So there was that sort of bit in there. There'll always be media hype. I think they're getting much better. They still do some strange things and they still have that ability to be quite caustic when they want to be. You know, the thing is, the media's there. It's always going to be there. You've got to try and deal with it. Hyping up games, well, that's how they sell papers, so I suspect they have to. So it's just, I suppose, all we ask for as cricketers or any sportsman does is, you know, they want to see the game reported on sort of fairly.
Yeah.
And if there is criticism to be had, make sure it's fair, you know, and that's all I think you can ever ask for. And as a player, you've got to accept that because you know if you've played badly, and if they say you have, then you've got to accept that. There's no point, you know, reading in the paper you play badly, knowing you have, and then getting really upset about it. So the players have got to sort of take that on board as well.
A two-way street.
It is a two-way street, and I think if you can always remember that, you know, within reason, you know, that the papers are generally okay. And you know, it's going to be so important this winter. There was a bit of friction this summer with the with the teams and or the team, the England team, and the press. And I think they've got to really calm that down because you don't want your own press on your back when you're touring, especially when the Aussies are going to be on your back from ball one. So I hope there's been a charm offensive somewhere. I think there has been. And I'm hoping that will have just calmed. People just got to understand that there's certain things you can and can't do these days. There's TV cameras everywhere. There's CCTVs. You know, there's phones. I mean, phones are the biggest bane where they can take photographs and record conversations and all sorts. Great if you're doing it business. When it's done sort of underhandedly or whatever, it causes problems. But as I say, you've just got to be careful. You know they're out there, and sadly, you have got to try and be as careful as you can.
Next question is from Linda Alexander. Any regrets about South Africa?
I suppose, yes, you'll always have regrets. I mean, I love playing for England and I couldn't for 3 years. Sadly, circumstances, you know, you never get forced into doing something because you've always got a choice, but the choices didn't seem particularly good at the time. And, you know, yes, I suppose missing out playing for England for 3 years was difficult.
And finally, a bit of a silly one, but sausage sandwich, red or brown sauce? That's from Mark Cran.
Mark, well, obviously wasn't listening to the radio about a month and a half ago. It might be even longer than that, I'm not sure. But I was on the show, sadly showed myself up because I got stage fright when I was asked about Oliver and trying to recollect some of the songs. And I just couldn't get the head round, and it's one of my favourite musicals, so I should have known quite a few of them. And could only sort of blurt out one or two. I should have got at least five or six. And I did tell them whether I like red or brown sauce. And so, Mark, perhaps you'd better ask somebody, because I'm not going to tell you. Find out.
Fair enough. Right, well, last month, MCC sent a touring party to Uganda for a couple of weeks. The tour was a huge success, as the club helped develop cricket in the heart of Africa, as the Ugandan national team were preparing themselves for their ICC T20 World Cup qualifiers. Here's Uganda coach Johan Rudolph talking to me in Kampala during one of the 50-over games.
We enjoy every moment of the guys' presence here. And we need to, from the coach, from my side, Randy, my assistant coach, and the players, to make use of this opportunity, speak to the guys. I mean, some of the guys play top-level cricket. And like I always said, you're never afraid. You never stop learning in cricket. You never stop. The day you stop, and then you just go play bowls or tennis or something else. It's a learning process, and the game is just moving forward all the time. I think we'll always have a legacy, MCC, within Uganda, and hopefully the guys will come back. I hope and I trust that you guys have been treated very well here. Also, you had an enjoyable trip. I believe the people went out of their way, and I mean, if there's always the possibility of a Kenya or a Namibia or Uganda, hopefully Uganda will be first on the list again. This is an A tour for you guys, so it'll be brilliant to host you guys again here within a year or two.
Johan Rudolph, Uganda's national coach, there discussing the recent trip to Uganda. Mike, how important are these tours?
Yeah, they're hugely important. I mean, I think the MCC, by nurturing these sort of trips and sending teams over, gives one parts of the world the recognition that they're actually playing cricket, because the MCC does gladly hold that sort of... if you like, air of being the cricket club in the world, and when MCC turn up, people sort of take notice, and it really is quite good. But you know, MCC teams do really enable the sort of focus to be put on an area, perhaps where it needs some help to get that focus, to get some attention, to get people sort of to back it and to grow it. And I think that's what the tours do. They get that sort of attention. They get a bit of inspiration. Certainly, I hope the people do who play against the MCC teams of, you know, how important we, the MCC, think those countries are to cricket, who are nurturing our great game. So, and I think also it's sort of important how the guys themselves who represented the MCC react and how they play the game. And they've got to remember that... you know, MCC in the spirit of cricket, and I hope you know, the guys when they're on tour do respect the people they're touring and visiting, and do try and help them as much as they can.
Absolutely. Well, the MCC plays over 500 cricket matches a year and sends around 4 touring parties abroad each year to help develop the game, as well as a women's tour every second year. One country that we've watched sort of a real success over the last few years has been Afghanistan. They played MCC in Mumbai back in 2006 and beat them. You were playing in that game. It's quite a story, isn't it?
It is, and you know, I didn't get too many that game either. There were some very talented cricketers there. One young lad got about 100 in, I think, about 12 overs, and sadly we dropped him in the first one, I suspect. But it was one of those, it is. It's a huge credit to the club, to MCC. Matthew Fleming had a huge amount to do with it, and was, along with others, really enabled Afghanistan to actually if you like, grow very quickly. And if you think it's almost been 10 years, but in 10 years they've now made it to a World Cup qualifier, finals. And you just think, blimey, you know, how's that happened? Yes, they're on the border of Pakistan, and yes, they've got some wonderful cricketers, but to actually get an infrastructure together and some cohesion to get to international level and get to a World Cup is huge credit to everybody involved, and obviously huge credit to Matthew and the MCC at the time for really taking the initiative and seeing the ability and the desire to actually play the game. Because you need that passion and desire to really do something like this, and a bit of help along the way just shows how MCC can influence and help. And it's really up to the passion of that particular country to see how far and how quickly they can get.
I know Johan Rudolph, the coach of Uganda, looks to Afghanistan as a real success story, and obviously you can't emulate exactly how they've done it, but it's one that he looks at. He also looks at Ireland as well. There's the two smaller nations that are, in his mind, pulling away slightly from the other cluster, and he wants Uganda to go with them.
Yeah, it does, but it takes that that structure, that infrastructure, the people running the game and the coaches and that desire and how quickly, you know, Ireland have been tremendous, haven't they? I mean, they've produced three England players, dare I say it, had you not taken perhaps those guys out of the Ireland side, would Ireland have sort of be where Afghanistan are now? I don't know, but certainly it is interesting that both Scotland and Ireland, but Ireland seem to have really sort of got their act together and are really taking it away. And it's good to see so many Irish lads playing. I mean, that to me is a real big thing, is that the country itself has taken a shine to it, and there's a passion about it now as much as there is other things in Ireland, whether it be rugby or anything else, or the hurling or whatever, or the Gaelic football even. But, you know, there seems to be that recognition now. And I think that's, what is needed. And I think Spain, for example, have just been recognised by their government as cricket being a sport. And so now they're going to start getting some, hopefully some extra support from the government, and hopefully they will start being able to grow too. So where there is that passion, that desire and that infrastructure to push, I do believe the game itself does help nurture those people that really want to push through, and hopefully it will always be the same.
Now I'm going to take a slightly off piste, and we're going to talk about football briefly in the middle of a cricket podcast at Lords, so we'll see how this goes. But it's after last month Lords successfully hosted the first ever London Sports Writing Festival. The four-day event was run by MCC in association with David Luxton Associates and saw some top sporting names and journalists hold fascinating panel discussions for audiences here at the ground. One in particular centred around the footballer Lionel Messi and the psychology needed in sport to get to the top. Messi biographer Guillaume Balaguer and former Chelsea manager Avram Grant chatted late into the night about the superstar. Here, Balaguer describes how an impatient young Messi risked everything for success.
Where does all this come from? And what it comes from is from the very strange upbringing that they had. And that's what I'm saying by, if I had a kid, I don't want him to be a player. Because this kid, imagine yourselves at 12, or your child at 12. He comes and says, I want to go to Australia, and you all have to come with me. And my two brothers have to come with me. My sister has to come with me. She's 5, but never mind. We're coming to the other side of the world because I want to be a footballer. At 13, 12, you don't even know if he's going to be a footballer. The family take the decision to go with him to Spain from Argentina, leave everything behind. That means everything. It's not like, and I'll get a EasyJet and go and see my cousin later on in the week. No, no, it's like leaving everything. And then 6 months later, mom cannot adapt, sister cannot adapt, and one of the brothers cannot adapt. So they have to go back to Argentina. All of a sudden, the family is broken. Broken family at 12. And you know, as a 12-year-old, that you've done that, and that you make sure that you are successful in what you're doing, because if you don't, you destroy your family, and you've destroyed your life, really, in a way.
Writer Guillaume Balaguer there on how a young Lionel Messi decided to uproot his whole family to follow a football dream.
Avram Grant then told the audience why his son didn't make it as a footballer.
My son was in a training here in some club. I don't mention the club, it was Arsenal. Please don't tell it to my wife, I won't. They played against a team, it was 6 years ago, and they let him, it was a friendly game, they let him play. And he scored two goals. It was 2-0 to the other team, he scored two goals, 3-2 for his team, and I was very proud. And I say to him, what's happened now? Everybody asked him, and he said, Daddy, you know, they're training three times a week. I said, come, you will not be a football player. He said, why? He said, because in your age, I say, only three times a week, why not six, why not seven, why not in the morning? If you want to be a football player, and I think Messi did it, you need to think always how to be a football player. If you think about something else, you will not do well.
Avram Grant there on what is needed to reach the top in football. He also went on to cite three things he believed you need to succeed in any walk of life: talent, passion and mental strength. Mike, what did you think about growing up?
Well, I mean, I was very lucky. I didn't fortunately have to uproot my parents, although they probably thought they were uprooted because they kept taking me around to different matches and having to get me there. And even on occasions, they allowed me to go on a bus and do it myself because I wasn't a great lover of them watching me sort of play. So, they would either drop me off or I'd get there to myself. But, you have to, certainly, those three things that were mentioned, the talent, the passion, the mental strength. I knew I had some passion for the game, but you don't know about mental strength and talent when you're young. You just know you like the game, you enjoy it, and you want to play. There's something there about a competitive spirit as well. And that's what you do when you're very young. So I suppose you could say I split up the family because I never really, saw Dad a great deal because I was out and he was at work trying to make sure that I could actually play these games. And then my brother was the same. So, we were fortunate in a way that the second job Mum and Dad did was actually they were steward and stewardess behind a sports club. At the firm that Dad played for, which is worked for Hanley Pages and then NCR, and so we were very lucky as two young boys to be able to play sort of morning, noon, and night. Now in the summer it was cricket and tennis, and you had sailing as well. You could ride your bike around there in those days and not be a problem. Then in the winter it was football, darts, and table tennis. So when you talk about the passion as a youngster and that. It is right, if you haven't got that passion, the talent won't come through, and then you won't understand much about the mental strength till later on, sadly. If you can get that earlier into somebody and get them to understand it, because it does take some understanding, what is mental strength and what you need to do, and it does take sometimes longer for others to actually grasp what it is. And that's, I think, why some of the younger boys, say Gower, played so much better, maybe Ian Botham, I don't know. Maybe because they were just overtly more talented than the likes of myself. But, I suppose one of the things that, and I probably don't want to have a pop at the players today, but when we started playing, and it gets back to Avram Grant saying, well, don't practice two, three times a week, or you've got to be every day, and that's what we did at the sports club. But fortunately, because we had the weekend to do it, and we're out there every hour we could, running around doing things. But when you came to my first few years here at Middlesex as a sort of 17-year-old, we didn't train as hard as they do now. But what we did do, certainly for the first 2 weeks, if we could get out into the nets, it was morning and afternoon. It wasn't just morning. And then once you did morning up, but you'd have a fielding session in there that was at least an hour long as well. So you're always practicing your skills, and you were doing it when you were stiff, you were doing it when you were cold, you were doing it because sometimes you had to do it, not because you wanted to, but you had to because others wanted to. So that's when that sort of mental strength started getting there. But again, if that passion's there, you don't mind doing it. And we didn't mind doing it. There were days where you were a bit tireder than others, but that's the thing you had to do. You had to get strong, not just mentally, but physically, to do the job you had to do. So when I see the guys have a morning session and have the rest of the afternoon off, I found that quite strange. And, especially pre-season, you know, you'd have thought you'd have, you know, most of the day. And I don't know whether that's fair or not, but I just get the sometimes it might be different in different clubs, but, you know, sometimes you don't see them practicing twice a day with lunch in between as we used to. So, again, and I know they have to do more training, and I know they do that sort of thing, and they're possibly fitter, maybe, than we were, although we used to play, train in the winter, playing football or playing squash or whatever. But I suspect they are probably fitter than us, although I wouldn't say they were that much fitter than Gucci, probably, but he was always running and doing all sorts of things. But we were good enough to do what we had to do, but I think we probably spent more times on the skills within the game than perhaps in gyms and stuff.
And the sacrifice, I mean, we picked an example, quite an extreme example there of Lionel Messi. I mean, that's a huge sacrifice he made. But how much sacrifice did cricketers and yourself did you make then?
Well, you had to, you know, and you became probably a little bit selfish for it, not because you wanted to be, but because you had to be. If you wanted to be the best, you had to be away, you had to be involved. And I suppose the sacrifices came when you got married and you started to have young children. And, you know, it is quite interesting how certain people deal with it, you know. And if you're going to get immersed in it and you're really sort of focused on your game, you know, and it sounds horrible, but, you know, yes, Lionel took his family with him because he wanted them there because he was very young. And then it would be sort of interesting to sort of, you know, family is so important. Family, it's interesting. When you're on tour, you know, the way I try to deal with it, so I missed them awfully, was try and put them out of your mind and you know, try and just get totally focused on what we had to do. And yet, when you got home was so important. It was something you desperately needed, having been away roaming around the world. That sort of home base was so important. You could go home and you felt like you were back and it was stable. You know, touring was very much a sort of a right, we're out there, how do we deal with it? You know, you're on your feet, you deal with it, you know, things you've never seen before, let alone, you know, how your body feels. And there were some real things you had to get your head around, you know, when you saw, you know, places like India with people on the streets and you know, it was just quite hard to take, and then your own body and things you had to do to make sure you didn't get ill. And when you did get ill, it was something you'd never really sort of, you know, had to cope with before, let alone try and play when you're not 100%. You know, you're not physically sort of injured, but your body's not feeling 100%, so you had to learn to play with that and get out there and make sure you did the best you could. So there were lots of things, but you know, the family side of things were horrible. I know my eldest, who got born in 83, was sort of in the middle of my sort of career, where for the first 5-10 years, you know, he didn't really see, you know, just that age where I was always away, and the number two son was sort of 86, he was born. He was a bit lucky because, you know, first 3 or 4 years I was, you know, I obviously ran about 1990, I didn't go very far, so I was there all the time. And so my oldest one certainly felt a bit left out. I know my wife is very, very good. She's extraordinary, really, because, you know, at the end of the day, you do have to be focused, you do get on with your life, and when you come home, it's like, you know, two different sort of people again, because you're used to doing what you've been doing up at this time, and then, you know, she's had her routine, so you've got your routine, and when you do come home, all you really want to do is just relax and just sort of sit on the sofa and watch all the Doctor Who things and Star Trek things you haven't seen, and go through all the bits and pieces. So I think that's a sort of picture that, you know, and to be fair, footballers don't go away that much. Yeah. You know, when you think we were away for 3 or 4 months at a time, totally away from the family. Footballers, you know, will tour and go around. Certainly if you move country, it's different.
Yeah.
And your family's not there, so you have to go back. But you do have time to go back. Whereas, you know, when you're away for 4.5 months, you know, and when we played, you know, it's changed, fortunately, that families can go out. Families do get paid for. When we were there, it was a, you know, you'd have a fee, and but if you brought the wife out, which is an airfare and all the hotel bills, you know, you didn't have much left to show for you, and you were playing for England, sort of thing. So fortunately that's changed, and it's the right way around. So yeah, there are many things, but I think cricket more than any other sport means you're away. Perhaps the golfing circuit, the tennis circuit, But they're always small little breaks. But when you're away, you're away. Because we did two tours a lot of the time, or one tour that was a long tour. So it was always 2 to 3 months. I'm not saying, you know, we're the only sport that does that, but it does seem to be cricket does take that sort of time.
History and Cricket with the Lords Podcast.
37 years ago, Derek Underwood took his final 5-wicket haul at Lords in a test match against the West Indies. The year was 1976, and it was the fourth time the Kent bowler, known affectionately as Deadly, achieved the feat. He's the only bowler ever to pick up 2 10-wicket hauls in tests at Lords, and was back at the ground recently for a book signing. I caught up with Underwood in the committee dining room, and first started off by asking him about his first 5-wicket haul here against New Zealand in 1969.
What I can recall is that the wicket was wet, and I can remember bowling a lot at Glenn Turner, who was, I think, making his debut. I have an idea he batted throughout the innings, which, on a wicket that was really doing enough, he batted brilliantly. And it was nice for me to get a haul like that, and in fairly early in my career, so I was pleased to get on one that turned.
And in 1974 against Pakistan, 13 wickets in that match.
Yes, that was
special.
Nice. I enjoyed that. There were a lot of I've bowled a lot of Pakistan over the years, and people like Zahir and Asif and Mushtaq and Majid, wonderful players. And it was nice to get them on a wicket that turned for once. And here, some water had seeped under the covers, and I'd bowled round the wicket to the left, to the right-handers for some considerable time. And lo and behold, I wasn't getting anywhere. The ball wasn't turning. And then I bowled a Wasim Raja, a left-hander, and suddenly the ball seemed to be turning. And so I bowled over the wicket and bowled across the right-hander, and we were in business. And that was one that I'll always remember, getting 8 for 50 here at this great ground.
Derek Underwood there, former MCC president, recalling bowling at Lords. How good was Underwood?
He was exceptional, yes. I mean, and I suppose he was more exceptional, as he alluded to there, when the wicket was slightly damp, because of the pace he bowled the ball and his accuracy and his ability to bowl a quicker ball at you. And he would just be metronomic at times. You know, when you talk about bowlers who get into that sort of way of bowling, Richard Hadley was another one, Malcolm Marshall another one, you talk about great bowlers. And Deadly, certainly, when it was wet, was unplayable. I do remember Mike Brearley, and he's very proud of it, and quite rightly so, playing at Canterbury on a dampish wicket, and Deadly was at his very best, and most of us struggled a bit, and Brearley's got 100 that day and played magnificently well, and he often regards that as probably one of his finest innings, and quite rightly so, because Derek, you know, was quite incredible. But it was a twosome, really, because, you know, I'm not sure many people could keep to Derek, you know, when he was turning, but Notty was just unbelievable. And, you know, when you're talking about take the ball up here, it's bounce and turn, and you heard him talking about, you know, bowling over the wicket, you know, and how much that's going to turn, how difficult that would be for a keeper to actually sort of navigate and keep to. So it's always a bit of a pair, but, you know, Derek certainly with uncovered wickets and that was just, you know, huge. But, you know, by the time, you know, you'd got to wickets being covered and being drier, he was still that good, because even on wet wickets you had to bowl a very good length, because, you know, because of the wetness it would stand up if it was too short, or, you know, you had to get the length right. And because he bowled it as a pace, you know, you just had to get it right, because if he got the pace right, you know, you just hope you had either missed it, or, you know, you managed to come straight through. But certainly by the time he had to bowl on drier wickets, he was still a huge handful on turning wickets, because he had that ability to be there, but not quite perhaps as much as when he bowled on the damp ones, where he was just almost unplayable. And, you know, he must have beaten the bat so many times, I suspect. But again, he just kept coming back at you. And he was a, you know, wonderful sort of bowler to have on your side, because, you know, he would be, you know, mentally strong. And he was. And for me, you know, you talk about left-arm spinners. We had one or two pretty good ones here at Middlesex, in Edmonds and Tufnell. You just sort of think, well, yeah, you know, would you rather have Underwood? And I suspect you know, with the guys we had, you'd say on dry pitches maybe not, but certainly on wet ones, well, you know, he was just a class above the rest.
Well, his record here speaks for itself, 38 test wickets, an average of just under 17. There's a great blog and video up on the Lords website at the moment on Underwood. Just go to www.lords.org to check it out. Well, as the Ashes fever was building, I also asked Underwood what he recalled about touring in Australia. The answer he gave suggested that it ain't what it used to be.
The whole system has changed for touring Australia. We used to leave in October and come back in March, which, when you think about it, was a long time to go on tour. And now it's all condensed, and so it's very, very different. You might play a test match in the old days and then have 3 or 4 days to train, practice, perhaps go out and see a little bit of the place and so on. And it gave players opportunities between test matches to regain some form, or for a player to get into the team. And I thought this was all very healthy. And whereas these days, obviously, it's, if you're in the first test match, there's a good chance you'll be there for all five. And I just think that it's... players, to a degree, miss out on their trip to Australia because all they see is the country from their hotel to the ground. Whereas I think, like to think that we also had a social role as well, and we had the opportunity to travel and see things that we would otherwise have not.
Derek Underwood on touring there and how it's changed. I guess two things really. It obviously has changed, but as you were alluding to earlier, I mean, maybe not for the worse. The family aspect of it is probably stronger now, whereas maybe what he's talking about, the social aspect of seeing the country and getting to know it, maybe less so.
Well, I suppose you could say that actually now the families are out there and do come out, then, you know, actually you perhaps should stay out there a bit longer, because it is important. You know, remember, you're playing cricket, you know, and sadly, as I said earlier, you do have to push the family to a side to be that focused, to be that sort of engaged. Yes, you want the family there when they can be there. Of course you do. And that's quite right. But, you know, once you get to sort of playing cricket, you know, people say, well, you know, if my wife's there, I'm going to play better. Well, OK, fine. Yeah, things have changed. But the thing to me is that, you know, we fell foul of this very, very much so, sort of very shortly after, you know, when I last won them in 86, was that the tours became shorter. You know, and that to me really did a disservice to cricket. And I think, you know, you can't just turn up in Australia and play a couple of, you know, 2-day matches or a 3-day match. You've got to get into the understanding that, you know, you are going to be in a battle. You are going to have people who are going to be fighting for their lives out there. You've got to get into the mentality of the way they play their cricket, because it is different. You know, and yes, we've played them here. But you don't. It's the whole country that gets there, and actually, you can play some good cricket that actually stands you in good stead. And we played all the states as Deadly did as well, I'm sure. You know, you would play 3 or 4 in a warm up, and then you'd have one between the first and second test match, and then one between the second and third. All right, you wouldn't have one between 4 and 5, but you know they were back to back test matches, always have been. And therefore you had that. But at least you had a period of time where, you know, you could actually, if somebody was out of form, if somebody did get some runs in that, you could put them in the next test match. And therefore you weren't, as Deadly alluded to there, you weren't just sort of, if you're in the first one, you're in the last one. If you had injuries, you know, what do you do? There's no matches for people to warm up in. What happens? You know, so there's that sort of thing. So it's not very fair on the players, I suspect, but it's the players that want it that way, apparently. They want it to be shorter. They don't like to be away for long. And I can understand that totally. You don't want to be away from your family. But, you know, you're representing England. Are you going to do a good job? What's the best way of doing it? Now, you know, things were the way they were in our day. Things are the way they are now. But I still respectfully suggest that, you know, you need to play 3 or 4 good warm-up games of 4-day matches to really give yourself a chance. And I think Andrew Strauss showed that when his team went to do that and said, right, we're going to try and win all these 3 games. We're not here just to practice. We're here to get in a winning mentality. And I hope that's, you know, some of the guys have learnt that from Straussie, and I hope Cookie tries to instil that too. Having said that, Cookie hasn't played, and 3 or 4 other our better players haven't. But, you know, I think within that, you've got a situation where hopefully from here on in there's going to be 2 4-day matches which I hope the full side will play in, and they will get some, you know, good rhythm and good, you know, understanding of what's going to happen out there.
And the social element that he was referring to there, is that sort of about being an ambassador for your country and getting out and seeing the country and promoting cricket? I guess maybe something which, to a degree, is what MCC do when they're on tour.
Yeah, they do, and I think that's possibly when you are up country, yes, you can get out and, you know, if you do play New South Wales, say up in Newcastle or somewhere, or you go somewhere in South Australia, a place called Woodner that we went to, you know, you're out in the country and you can play some, you know, interesting cricket, but you do get out into there and see, you know, see a bit of the countryside and see, you know, what is a vast country. You get out to Bowral and see Bradman's sort of museum and stuff like that, or you can do. And there are lots of places to see in and around Australia. But if you're not playing the States, you'll never get there. You'll only play at the Test match grounds, which are wonderful grounds anyway, but and you can see a little bit of the time. But I think Derek's right. There are two things, actually. Two is about the people, but also the other's about the players. You know, we used to sit in the dressing room after every day. If you were fielding, you'd go to your dressing room, and the batting side would come in and bring some beers, and you'd sit down and have a drink after the end of the play. I know they can't do that these days, but it's one of those things, you know, that the professional game has sort of said, right, we don't want to be too friendly with our opposition. But, you know, it was a nice way to play the game, and people did come in and have a drink, you know, because it's being able, that mental strength, being able to sort of, you know, come off the field and just, you know, switch off and say, actually, you know, bare bloke, mate, are you? You know, actually out there, that's a bit of, you know, that's our business, and, you know, we're up for it and we want to win, and it's your business too, so we'll have a bit of, you know, we'll have a bit of few words and we're having a beer now, mate, good on you, you know, enjoyed it. And I think that's an aspect that I really quite enjoyed. You actually got to know the people you became friends with, and friends for life. You can sit down and, you know, but if you don't get to know people, you know, to me it's sad. And you do at the end of a series now, but I always quite enjoyed that side of it.
Absolutely. And bringing it back to Lords now, finishing up. Busy Christmas period ahead. At the beginning of the podcast, you said that you'd done more revision than you'd done since school. So
yeah, certainly for the SGM. yes, it's been a very interesting. It's a wonderful club. There's so much that goes on here. Derek Brewer and his team do a great job, and you know, things are ever improving here. And hopefully, in 2 years' time, we'll be looking over at the Warner stand and seeing a wonderful new stand over there that the members will be very proud of, and certainly it will get the ground up to scratch again, because we're a bit behind on ICC sort of ground regulations for all that sort of stuff, so that would be nice. And then the next one is a tavern, and hopefully whilst I'm in situ, we'll get that underway too, and hopefully again by the time the you have the World Cup down here and India again, you might even see another tavern stand. And then that for me means I've seen every stand here rebuilt at Lords, which is amazing from what it was and what it is now. And it still sort of retains that wonderful sort of atmosphere. But of course, you know, we've got that 200th anniversary, you've got Middlesex's 150th anniversary, so there'll be a MCC President's 11 versus a Middlesex President 11 at some stage during the summer. We're going to have a, you know, wonderful weekend of cricket, I believe, with Hertfordshire playing here, which is the side we played 200 years ago in the first match here at Lords. And then Harrow and Eton and I think Oxford and Cambridge are going to make up that weekend. And then, of course, the World 11s versus MCC, both women's and girls, which is tremendous. So on that side of thing, there's lots to look forward to, and there's lots of events that are going to go on through the year. And I think one of the big things, and I'm very happy to work with our chief exec over, is trying to get in and around the local community. We've employed Laura Brown, of course, so everybody's getting to know now, our community manager, and she's doing a great job. And I hope we can become more user-friendly within in and around the local communities, because being a local boy myself, Wilsdon just up the road, it's it's nice to see the ground changing and making it more accessible to others and helping out in the community. We do a lot of help all around the world, and yet sometimes we just forget about what's happening around here. So it's great that Derek has also decided he thinks that's a way forward. So, and I'm very happy to do that, because that just ties in nicely with the work we do at the ECB as well. And I think it's going to be good for the ground and all who sail in there at Lord's.
Well, that's certainly a busy year ahead, and I wish you the very best of luck with it.
Thank you.
And thanks for coming on the podcast.
Pleasure.
Lovely. Well, many thanks for tuning in. We'll be back next month with more cricketing stories from Lord's. So remember to follow us on Twitter. We're at Home of Cricket. Be our friend on Facebook. And for all the latest news from Lord's, just go to lords.org. See you soon.
Tired of ads interfering with your favorite sports podcasts? Good news. Ad-free listening is available on Amazon Music for all the music plus top podcasts included with your Prime membership. Stay ahead of the game by downloading the Amazon Music app for free, or go to amazon.com/sportsadfree. That's amazon.com/sportsadfree to catch up on the latest episodes without the ads.
Hey everyone, Craig Robinson here. I want you to check out the Ways to Win podcast, brought to you by Ford and the new 2024 Ford F-150 truck. On Ways to Win, Coach Cal and I will discuss leadership lessons we've learned. We know all about the days spent perfecting your craft outside of the limelight, and have knowledge to share about how strength, inspiration, encouragement, and adaptability are the key ingredients to drive toward your dreams. And those same ingredients can be found in the new 2024 Ford F-150 truck. So check out my podcast, Ways to Win, and also check out the new 2024 Ford F-150 truck. Learn more at Ford.com. Built Ford tough, built Ford proud.